We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, my name is Kim. You are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Mark. Mark, how are you?
I'm great, Kim. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Boy, there was a lot laying under the surface of this episode of Unsolved Mysteries.
This was a lot of fun to do the research, even though the stories are really tragic, and some of them are really heartbreaking, but all in all, I'm really happy to... These stories were completely off my radar. I don't know about you. I had seen this episode previously, but it's not until we started doing Unsolved Mysteries Rewind that I decided to really kind of go down and do some research on people. I mean, there's no other reason to previously. And I'm kind of dumbfounded by some of the information that we were given and the information that didn't make it to Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, and we are, of course, talking about Season 12, Episode 12. The first story that they cover, I would say, to pat ourselves on the back, I would say we did 80% of the research on this one, and we used 20% of Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, I'm going to say this was a little bit of a lazy story for Unsolved Mysteries, and the laziness really shows in the title of their story.
Oh my God, you want to do the honors?
Well, the name of the person... Her last name is Wood, and the story is called Wood, I Lie to You. Oh, it's like a dad joke.
Yeah, it's kind of tacky.
It is. It's kind of like, hey, you know it would be a good title, right?
Ugh. Yeah, exactly.
We gotta funny it up. All right.
We got a lot of this info from ShaliscePaul.com and, of course, the wonderful Unsolved Mysteries Wikipedia. So... It's 1939, and professional race car driver John Paul Sr., that's his first and last name is John Paul, he's actually born in the Netherlands, and he is born Hans Johan Paul, but the family later immigrates to the United States.
Yeah, this is a weird one. I know a lot of people in Norway, and I know a lot of John Pauls, and their real names are always Hans. Which is kind of funny. I would have Hans, personally, but apparently Hans is a very, very common name there.
Yeah, I'm sure John is a lot more exotic over there.
Yeah, right?
Well, he's, like, just constantly trouble from the get-go. Like, in 1979, I know that you found that he was apprehended on this big old boat and customs discovered $10,000 on board and some marijuana residue.
Well, he had nearly a ton, though, of, they would later on find that this would lead to a rented truck that was parked nearby that contained over 1,500 pounds of marijuana. Another thing is, John Paul Jr. was a part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
Do you know how old John Paul Jr. would have been?
Not at this time. I do know that he had John Paul Jr. with his first wife, Joyce, and I know that in 1981, he's with his second wife, so I'm not exactly... Or 1980, excuse me, he's with his second wife, so I'm sure he was like 20s, maybe, because John Paul Jr. is also a professional race car driver.
Right. Now, I'm just kind of looking, just for curiosity's sake, what does a pound of pot of marijuana go for? I'm going to do a quick search. I mean, it's one of these things where if you think about it, I should be able to get a legitimate price, especially where it's legal, right?
But Well, while you're doing that, because I am curious to know, in May of 1980, John Paul Sr. marries his second wife, Shalice Paul. And in 1981, she's actually the extra in the very beginning of Cannonball Run who like spray paints out the speed limit sign.
That is so funny.
Yeah, it was a bizarre thing, but their marriage was like very, very rocky. She said that he cheated on her on their honeymoon. Like, he was just passing it around.
Yeah, like, so, this guy is off his rocker. I mean, he's just, I mean, stereotypical early 80s, late 70s type of chaos person. Probably like, I love America, you know?
Chaos in the life of somebody who is rich and famous, you know? So he kind of convinces Shalice to come back and rekindle things with him. So she flies from Atlanta, where they were shooting Cannonball Run, to Florida to see him. And that's the last time she is ever seen.
Yeah.
Now, oh, yeah.
No, no, I'm just saying. So that was in about 1982?
1981.
Oh, 1981.
And she is the first of at least four people that go missing, and the last person they're seen with is John Paul. In 1982, Richard Berlin goes missing, and he's last seen with John Paul, supposedly. And sometime in 1983, David Casorla goes missing, and he was also supposedly last seen with John Paul. In April of 1983, his partner in crime with this, like, drug trafficking was a guy named Stephen Carson. And Stephen Carson was shot by John Paul three times. He actually fired five shots, but three hit Stephen Carson. Apparently, Carson had been given immunity in a drug trafficking case, and he was presumably about to kind of turn on John Paul and turn state's witness. So John Paul is arrested for shooting him, but while he's out on bail, he fled. And he was actually, he fled to, like, Switzerland, I think, and he was extradited back to the United States in 1986, and he received a sentence of 25 years for the attempted first-degree murder on Stephen Carson.
And this is all before our story even begins.
Oh, we have a lot to go before our story even begins. Like, in, I know this is your favorite part. I'll let you tell this part. In March of 1987.
Okay, so, they decided, well, Paul made friends with an inmate, and they decided, well, I don't know if they were friends, but they decided to attempt to escape prison, and they made a mixture. I don't know how they would even obtain these things, but a mixture of pine salt and hot sauce. Mm-hmm. And they sprayed it in the guard's face, and they tried to scale a 12-foot fence, which really shouldn't be. I mean, when the adrenaline's running, I'm thinking that these guys shouldn't have too much of a problem.
Yeah.
But the guard fired two shots because he recovered pretty quickly. You would imagine that he's also has some adrenaline running. And they surrendered like immediately.
Yeah.
Which I'm going to guess this entire thing took less than 3 minutes.
I think so. Because they said he just fired like two warning shots and they were like, oh, okay, we're back. But when police did like a full scale investigation, they found like a fully ready to go abandoned truck just outside of the prison. And that's where they think they were running to. So where we meet Unsolved Mysteries and all of these people, all of our players, is in April 1998. And this episode of Unsolved Mysteries was released in August of 2002. So in April of 98, we meet 51-year-old divorced mother of two, Colleen Wood. And she's like lived in Ohio her whole life. She's sick of shivering her butt off and she wants to move to Boca Raton, Florida.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I feel really bad for the woman because I have a feeling that she probably just had that awakening where she met this guy. He seems exciting.
Yeah.
We're going, you know, and he's got all these amazing ideas and she's just, you know, I'm ready to party type of attitude. Know.
She raised her two adult kids. Like, she is done with that. It is time for her, like, second half of her life. So she actually works at Lighthouse Point Marina. She works for Marine Canada. And, you know, everything's going fine. In July of 1999, Paul is paroled. So he is out. In early 2002, Colleen met John through a personal ad that was looking for a, quote, sailing companion. And she was really impressed by him because he actually did have, like, successful mutual fund companies. I know he bought stock in Mattel very early on. And, like, Kentucky Fried Chicken. Like, he was a successful guy. He had an MBA from Harvard, and he was a famous race car driver.
And all of that is confirmed that, you know, he had that education?
Yep.
Wow. So, I mean, all right, so the guy was clearly a very intelligent person, but also, like you said, he made some wise investments here and there, so he had some money. But the way that they kind of presented him was, that he had a lot of wealth.
Yes.
And I don't think he had a lot of wealth. And I think that the red flags that are to come are, you know, kind of prove that. And she should have known better, I think.
I mean, I hear you. I'm always reticent to be like, eh, she should have known. But, you know, she's blinded by love. And, right. You know, you don't think like, oh, this person's trying to scam me, unless you do a podcast like this and we're suspicious of everybody and we don't let people in. But I will say that I think he has like rich guy money tied up in things problems. Like he has this huge boat. He's got his mutual funds. I don't know if that's the same as like going to the ATM and taking out a bunch of cash.
Right. Yeah. And so what she does is they decide to sail the world together, which of course is one of these things I guess people talk about. It horrifies me to go on this boat. I mean, it's I'm glad that you said that because I don't know. I don't know how big that sailboat is, but I picture being in the middle of an ocean with like 1,000 miles this way, 1,000 miles that way. And all you have is this big wave coming towards you or something. And this stupid life jacket.
Or God forbid you're on the boat with a lunatic or something. You know, I will happily go on a boat in a river, in a lake, somewhere where I can swim to the side and get to safety. But an ocean is like a whole different kettle of fish. But they're taking 5 years off to sail the world together.
Oh, my God. I wouldn't want to go. Yeah, I'm just it horrifies me to go on what I consider to be a relatively small boat, even though it's I guess it would be a yacht. Right.
Yeah, I think I want to say they said like 52 feet.
All right. And I don't know. I just don't see it being big enough.
Personally. Yeah. Well, compared to the ocean, it's tiny, you know? Yeah. So she ends up selling her condo and she gives all the money to John.
Right. It becomes like kind of like a couple's fund, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. This is our mad money for when we're, you know, traveling the world. So they move in together on the Island Girl. That's the name of her boat. And she quit her job at the marina. Now, here we go. This timeline is going to get a little tighter. So on December 3rd of 2000, Colleen calls her sons, Michael and Todd, and she told her sons that they were going to set sail in a few weeks for this trip around the world. Now, on December 13th or 14th, Marine Canada, who is Colleen's former boss, speaks with Colleen, and she invites Colleen to the office Christmas party, even though Colleen's not working there anymore. And Colleen's like, oh, we're in a bar 200 miles away in Key West and we are partying. But yeah, we will be there. Now, that's the last time that we know that anybody's had contact with Colleen. So on December 16th of 2000, presumably John places two ads in the newspaper. One was an ad looking for a first mate on a schooner. And the other was a man looking for a world. Looking for a lady to sail the world with him. And all of these ads were placed using Colleen's credit cards.
I mean, can you imagine, like, let's say hypothetically he's killed this woman and she's no longer in the picture. He, the next day, wakes up and goes, you know what I need to do today is find another person. It's bizarre to me. And let me pay with her credit cards.
That it's so shady. Yeah. And it's just days after she had talked to Maureen on the phone. So it's so sketchy. So on December 19th, Colleen actually misses the Christmas party. But, you know, she was last seen partying.
It's 200 miles away. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the map, I mean, you really have to go a very large distance to even make that trip. And I would imagine, I don't know, it just doesn't seem like the kind of thing that you just do. Mm-hmm. Maybe is that a thing that you might know about? Do people just jump on their boat and they're like, yeah, no problem. I'll just be there, even though it's a very far distance.
They don't have jobs. They have money in the bank. You know, I think maybe like a retiree, well-off couple. Yeah, maybe they would. Like, I could see my mother-in-law and her husband doing something like this. But I don't know. They would call us every once in a while, too.
Right. And you're kind of at this point thinking that was the plan, at least. She seems relatively close to her children. And that's what raises the red flags, because we don't get a word from her. New Year's comes and goes.
Yeah, we don't hear her from her for Christmas. We don't hear from her for New Year's. So Todd's wife, so Colleen's daughter-in-law, calls Colleen's cell phone. And she gets like one of those automated messages that the account is closed.
Crazy.
Yeah, and one of her sons calls the police in Florida, and the police are like, sorry, there's no evidence of a crime. You know, maybe she's just out partying on a boat.
Now,
and
I'm wondering, I wonder how often out there things just kind of get dismissed because of international waters, you know, which I believe is 9 nautical miles, which is about 12 miles off the shore. Okay. I know here on Long Island, that falls into some categories because you can go on, you know, gambling is illegal here, but they have like, you know, ships that you can take and it goes like 12 miles out and you can gamble. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
it's just kind of strange to me that I wonder if it falls into that where it's like, well, she's in international waters and it's really out of our jurisdiction.
But like how if maybe. You are just like traveling around the world, and this is my ignorance of sailing knowledge, but is there a way in 2000 where you can call somebody out in the middle of the ocean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
I don't know.
I'm going to say no. I mean, I'm going to imagine you would use like shortwave radios and stuff. It'd be much more reliable than a cell phone in the year 2001. It doesn't seem. God. I mean, I had a phone. I had my first cell phone in 1999, and it worked everywhere, but it seemed like I remember I was upstate New York in the middle of nowhere, just no signal. So, yeah. I mean,
God forbid you're roaming.
You're in the middle of the ocean. Oh, my God, yeah. But, yeah, if you're in the middle of the ocean, I'm going to guess there's not a cell phone tower anywhere near you.
Yeah, so Michael, the son, is like scouring the internet. He wants to find his mom. So he's looking for John Paul. So he's Googling, Yahooing maybe for this 2000. And he
Alta Vista ring.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm Prodigy. No, I'm kidding.
Well, he finds an article that John Paul was actually sentenced to the attempted murder of Stephen Carson. He served 15 of the 25 years.
Wow.
So their little trip to sail around the world was crazy, violating his parole. But of course, you know, Colleen didn't know about that. So John later gave 3 different accounts of what happened. So version number 1, John's daughter actually told Michael, Colleen's son, that John said that Colleen became irate because one of his old girlfriends called and she broke up with him in December. The second version of his story is that they had an argument, but he doesn't remember what it's about. So she like hops off the boat and she comes back later with 2 quote football player types.
Strange.
And,
yeah.
Okay. I was like, are they trying to say African American in a really tasteless way? What's
See, I didn't get that. What I got was that she went and hooked up with 2 guys and they came to help her out. I'm picking up all their stuff and she's going to hang out with them.
Well, that's what I thought, but I thought that they were also trying to say, but those guys were African American. But it really doesn't matter. They actually, he specifically said white, so I know that for sure. But he says that they grabbed all of her belongings and left the boat and hasn't seen her since. Which, that's the story that he actually told Michael.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems very strange that a number of things happened that make no sense. And the third story is that they had a fight over money and that Colleen actually owed him money, but she wouldn't repay it.
Right. So there's no evidence for a crime still, but all the way in April of 2001, so like 4 or 4.5 months after Colleen disappears, a missing persons report is finally able to be filed. So we get to meet detectives Mark Shotwell and Al Stone. They're both on this episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and they find that in December and January, there was 80 credit card charges, which totaled $38,000.
That's some serious credit line. Holy cow.
Especially considering like cash advances and stuff. And they said, we have evidence that Colleen didn't make the charges because it turns out that ATM cameras showed a couple different women using the cards to withdraw the money.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just surprised that, a couple things. I'm always surprised that ATMs were the first place to find surveillance cameras, I think.
I know.
Especially when you see some of this footage, you know, we see like, I mean, it's terrible, but at the same time, it's useful, especially for the time. But do you think he just sold the credit cards to people? Do you think, like, what do you think was the deal here? Girlfriends?
Well, as a matter of fact, I know exactly what happened. He actually, the police were able to identify the women and they went to go interview them. And the women said that John Paul just approached these pretty ladies and was like, hey, here's the credit card here or debit card. Here's the PIN. So if you withdraw as much money as you can, I'll let you keep like 20% of it.
Mm.
But bring the rest back to me. And they were like, okay, yeah, cool. That doesn't raise any questions.
Yeah, I mean, I would probably flip it and go, I'll give you 20% if I can keep 80, because I'm the one whose face is going to be on the stupid thing.
Well, then you'd probably get shot, because we know how John Paul likes to operate. So police want to talk with him, but they can't find him at all. So in May of 2001, they're finally able to track him down. And they just said he was like increasingly nervous during the questioning. And it turns out that he leaves town, violates his parole, and police want to speak with him. And that is where we leave Unsolved Mysteries.
This guy has such a history of just fleeing.
Yeah.
I can't believe he was out. I mean, it amazes me that the police are not keeping more of a tab on him. Like, he shouldn't even legally be allowed to have a boat.
Oh, no, definitely not. And like, okay, so Unsolved Mysteries, as we said, it airs in August of 2002.
Mm-hmm.
So when it airs, he actually changes the name of his boat from Island Girl to Diamond Girl.
Oh, my God. It's kind of like, just paint the car. You know, nobody will know.
Exactly. And so we do have a few sightings from him since. But before I do, can I just say, I received a message from Shalisa's sister, and apparently I was pronouncing her name wrong. It is Chowlis.
Chowlis.
Chow, like Chowlis.
What a beautiful
Chowlis.
Name.
Yeah. So, but back to our regularly scheduled programming. In 2004, JP, John Paul, was spotted sailing in the Fiji Islands, and somebody called Unsolved Mysteries to report it, but they couldn't extradite him because Fiji and the United States do not have an extradition treaty. So he got word of it, sailed to Europe, sold his boat in like an Italian boating magazine.
Like, what is that? Yeah.
Yeah, and he got a bunch of cash from that, apparently, because in 2011, he was thought to have moved to Thailand and opened up a dive shop. But Thailand does have an extradition treaty with the United States. Now, according to Chowlis's sister, as of April 2020, he is thought to be in the Netherlands, and he is dying of lung cancer. But if he is still alive, he would be 81 years old today, and he has never been captured.
This is crazy to me. It is really crazy that he's out there currently, of course, dying of lung cancer. But, I mean, he really, how much time did he serve in his whole life?
Like 15 years, maybe like 20, considering his early stuff.
Now, of course, we are assuming that he's guilty in this. Why, you know, why run? But I don't know. The guy's a real shady guy. So,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. But speaking of shady people who did not serve nearly enough time for what they've done, we moved to White Bear Lake, Minnesota.
Yeah, I'd like to visit a place called White Bear Lake, Minnesota. It sounds nice.
You know, my love of Little House, I have such Minnesota envy.
Well, not right now, though. Right now, it's a little turbulent there. But,
oh, yeah.
But I'm hoping it's going to go back. So we have 40-year-old Jean Weaver. And her marriage is kind of like a lot of marriages. It's, you know, kind of struggling is what I'll say. But Jean, and you made a note to say how harsh she was. When she wanted to end this marriage, at least in a reenactment, she wanted to end it. It's like, nope, it's over. Sorry.
No, she was like, okay, the reenactment, they show her being so mean and her husband being so passive. But she goes, this joke of a relationship.
Yeah, I felt like, bad for him right off the bat.
Yeah, I did too. But, you know, I feel like a couple times in Unsolved Mysteries, they're trying to get us to side with the husband, and I am not here for it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if she had taken a meat cleaver to his skull, yeah, you know what? I'm going to feel bad for the guy. But. Oh, yeah. But that's not what happens here. What happens is she decides that after 17 years of marriage, it's over. And as you stated, she thinks it's a joke of a marriage, got to run. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that maybe people should do, especially if you know, find somebody, go on a sail around the world. But maybe that.
Well, apparently, like, it has been bad for a while, and they were going to stay together until their son graduated high school. So one of Kathy's sisters actually gets like terminal, I think, brain cancer, and she dies. And Jean. Jean was like, life is too short to stay with someone that you just hate. So it seems like this tension has really been building for a while.
Yeah. So on this one particular thing, they were I'm sorry, I just lost my page, just closed. Can you pick up? Reopen?
So she tells him that she's going to leave him. And 3 days after she's leaving, Jean's sister, Kathy, becomes worried because she can't get a hold of Jean. And they were going to go on vacation together because Jean was supposed to catch a ride with Kathy and Kathy's husband. So they're calling and they can't get a hold of her. She's always on time, but they have not been able to get a hold of her for like 45 minutes. So they just drive to her house to see what's up. And Kathy runs up to the door and sees like the windows are all black and the smoke alarm is going off.
This is crazy because my house being so old, I would imagine I'd see smoke coming out of things. But this was like hermetically sealed or something. Of course, it's a reenactment. But they're looking through the windows and they see there's all this smoke. So they find a way to get in.
Well, yeah, she tells Tom, she's like, call 911, call 911. And she starts like busting the windows out of the house. Very good on you, Kathy. Like very fast thinking. So 3 minutes later, firefighters do arrive and they go into the house, and in the basement, they find that it's like kind of flooded because the fire was so hot. It actually broke the water pipes open, which to me was kind of almost like a sprinkler system. Not intentionally.
Yeah. But, it was very odd, right? Like I kind of like, oh, well it was lucky in that sense because even though it appears that somebody was trying to burn her body and any evidence associated to her body, the broken water pipe created, like you said, like a sprinkler and allowed an autopsy to be put on her body. And it's terrible. I mean, I just want to state, you know, she of course died. And it looks like foul play. It's terrible.
This is going to be really rough for you guys. But yeah, they find Jean's body. She was actually still alive when they found her, and she had been set on fire. So as you can imagine, she had like skin melted off, and she died very quickly after, thank God, because I can't imagine living with that level of pain.
Yeah.
And they find that soot was in her lungs when they do an autopsy, and they find that she was alive for 10 minutes after being set on fire.
That's crazy. I mean, I'm imagining, wasn't she in the basement?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm imagining the smoke would have just risen, and she was in this one little area where it was still very, very smoky.
God, it's so horrible. I can only hope she was, like, unconscious.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just one of those type of situations where I couldn't imagine having to go through that.
But we do find out that she did have also severe head injuries. So everybody's kind of looking at the husband because he was just like a loner, a loser. They say, you know, he suffered from depression. Like, okay, that doesn't make you a killer. But he was unsuccessful in his personal life, in his professional life. And
in the bedroom? No, I'm just kidding.
Probably.
But you know, it's one of these things also. How much time, do we know how much time it was between her confronting him about the divorce and this happening?
3 days.
3 days. I mean, it's the first person that you're thinking of.
Yeah, and in another 2 days, if they waited two more days, then he wouldn't be the beneficiary on her life insurance. So we're all kind of looking at Gordon at this point.
Now, what an idiot. Because if you're going to do this, if you're in such a, you know, a rage to do this, you pay the bill and you wait a month. No, I'm not trying to make a joke. So obvious. Like, what, you just didn't want to make the payment or something? Or maybe she was, I don't know. It just seemed to me, maybe that was it. Maybe she's like, well, I'm not going to renew that.
Maybe, or maybe she was like, I'm going to make my sister a beneficiary or make our son a beneficiary or something.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The cops call Gordon and are like, we need to talk to you, sir. So Gordon comes home and we meet Detective James Braun, who kind of met with Gordon at the police station and interviewed him. So they take a look at the clothing that he was wearing that day, and they actually found traces of two flammable liquids on him that they also found on Jean.
Mm-hmm.
So Kathy, the sister, just thinks that they were arguing. Gordon pushed Jean. Jean kind of accidentally hit her head, and he panicked and lit her on fire instead of, you know, calling for help. So 12 days after her death, Gordon is arrested, and he is later free on bail. And here is where we start getting real crazy with this story. 4 months after he is free on bail, and it's a week before he's set to be indicted for her murder, he borrowed his parents' car to go on a solo vacation to Chicago.
Yeah, this is a weird reenactment because it's the parents are obviously aware that all of this is going on.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and they're saying, oh, yeah, take our car. It's fine. You're going to go on a vacation. You need a vacation right now.
And the parents are the one who's bailed him out. Like, I think these parents just, you know, poured over this guy. They said in the beginning that his parents were very wealthy, but, you know, Gordon never had any luck in that department. So they find this car abandoned in a suburb outside of Chicago, and there's blood all over the car. And they think, oh my God, he must have been killed in a carjacking. And I'm not exaggerating. There's car blood all over this car.
Yeah, it was nasty in the reenactment. But they determined that although the blood was human, they couldn't determine if it was his.
Which begs the question, where did it come from?
Right. I mean, is it more than one person's? I don't know. I just feel like this, it's not like this is in 1951.
Right. Yeah, this is 2000. Or no, this is actually 99.
But still, there was, you could, I don't know. I don't know about the technology behind DNA, but I'm going to guess that if they could tell it's human, they can tell if it's the person's, unless they didn't have DNA from him.
I don't, it's very possible. It's, this is all, I was left with so many question marks at this detail, but, 2 days after the car is found, presumably he died in a carjacking, a business associate of Gordon's gets a telephone call from Gordon. So we know now that Gordon is on the run. Now, a lot of this update I got from a Dateline episode called The Stranger. And oh my God, if you guys want to hear about his crazy adventure while he was on the run, I highly recommend checking that out. But basically, in 2004... after 4 years on the run, a woman ID'd Gordon off of a mugshot that she saw on America's Most Wanted. And he was actually living in Florence, Oregon, going by the name David Carson. Now, in 2005, he was charged with first degree murder, but he was actually convicted of second degree murder. I believe the difference is premeditation.
Okay.
You know, first degree is if it was with premeditation. Second degree is if you're arguing with your wife, you push her and you decide to set her alight. So he actually is sentenced to 25 years for that. Now, in 2006, Gordon's parents were actually arrested for helping him elude the police. And, you know, it was kind of a slap on the wrist because the charges against the dad were dropped. I guess he was terminally ill and they just decided not to go forward with it. But the mom was sentenced to just community service.
I think that's a little too light, in my opinion.
They provided the funds. they knew where he was. And this Dateline, I said, they said that the mom talked to him every week on the phone. Like, it's just crazy. So in 2007, he was granted a new trial because they said, like, oh, it was unfair to have the medical examiner speak at the first trial. But because he was already convicted of second degree murder because of double jeopardy, he can only be convicted of second degree murder at the highest now. Like, first degree is completely off the table. So in 2010, he's once again convicted of second-degree murder and is sentenced to 18 years and 9 months in prison. So good behavior usually cuts that time in half. And with time served, he was paroled out in November of 2016.
All right. So I had this question of paroled out versus paroled. What does that mean?
Now, if I'm just going by my, you know, SV University degree, like just from watching crime shows and stuff, paroled out is like
halfway the process. House type situation. Oh, okay.
No, I think it's like going in front of the parole board and the process of leaving. Being paroled is like being on probation and you have to be good and you have to check in with your parole officer because he is on parole until 2023, but he is just out. He's just living his life.
Wow.
For setting a woman on fire, a woman that he claimed to love, he is out. And I have his most recent mugshot. I'll post it so you can, you know, stay away from that guy. But, yeah, apparently you only have to serve like 9 years and some change.
Yeah.
And going on the run and evading police. Ridiculous.
It's just, I don't like this whole getting out for good behavior nonsense. It really doesn't sit well with me. You know, if you did the crime and you're given 25 years, you shouldn't get six.
I completely agree. And usually it's like half, but I mean, I could not agree more, but it's overcrowding. It's a whole host of other political issues and stuff like that. So
don't preach to me. No, I'm kidding.
I will.
But you know, sir, I mentioned Circleville Paul, who was found guilty for just trying to kill somebody, maybe. And he got 7 to 25 years. So, I mean, the bottom line is if you want to just go through it, you know, if you just want to kill the person, you may as well just kill them because it's really not that much more of a punishment.
I agree with you, but I will also say we do not hold ourselves responsible for any behavior that the listeners of this podcast may do.
Everything I say, all of my advice is all hypothetical.
Yeah, exactly. And I hear you. I mean, oh my God. And Paul didn't, Circleville Paul did not go on the run, you know, all those things. It's just horrible. So yeah. Speaking of really upsetting things, we move on to our third story. What happened to Natasha?
Yeah, what happened to Natasha? Sandra Jennings receives a phone call from her brother Clarence, and he's desperate to find his daughter Natasha. Now, Clarence, immediately we see him and we're thinking he's shady right away, right? Am I wrong?
Can I just tell you he goes by the nickname Spider? So yeah.
Yeah, of course he does. He's the type of guy who is probably coming to my house today to give me a quote on contracting.
God, I hope not. I
mean, well, so far it's been that way. So the he calls his calls Sandra to go check on Natasha. Natasha is staying with them for the summer.
Yeah, her parents are divorced. She's from Southern California. Spider, you know, Clarence, lives in Carson City. So he's just, like, calling the home. And right. Sandra, his sister, picks up. And she's like, Natasha? Yeah, sure, I'll go check.
Goes upstairs and sees that she's on the floor. And there's a fan toppled up, toppled on her. And he's like, oh, my God. And he's like, hang up right now and call 911.
And if you guys want an Easter egg to look for there, during that scene when she finds her body at 26 minutes and 54 seconds, Natasha, dead Natasha on the ground, the reenactor, opens her eyes.
You got to post that little gif. That is,
oh, I will.
It's one of those things where it's very Ed Wood. It's very like, wow, I can't believe. I mean, they must have left it in knowing that she did that. Right?
It was crazy. I was like, why wouldn't you cut that a half a second earlier? Like,
or just freeze frame it or something.
Yeah. So she kind of has this fan like against her neck, it looks like. So she tells Clarence, like, oh my God, I just found her. She's laying on the ground. Like, I can't wake her up. And he's like, call 911. So paramedics arrive, but sadly, 16-year-old Natasha is already dead.
Now, one of the things that came out of this, I know I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but whenever they find somebody who's young like this, they always rule it a homicide. That's what the officer said, or the detective said. And I don't know. I never heard of that before.
I didn't either, but I like that. I was like, that is very interesting. He says, yeah, when someone's young, found dead, it's homicide until proven differently.
Now, do we ever know why Clarence was calling outside of just to touch base?
No, I think he just wanted to check on his daughter. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think he called the house multiple times. And just, you know, one day the sister happened to pick up. So that's where he went and did it. But oh, my God, we get to meet Natasha's mom, Tammy Stilton. And I feel so bad for her. This woman, you can tell in her eyes and her mouth, like, she has been through the
ringer. She's pissed. Yeah, she was pissed then. She might have been pissed before this happened. But she's a very intense person, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, right. I find that with a lot of these mothers of children who they can't get answers for their children's death, they are so focused and like a bulldog with this. And good, you should be. We learn time and time again that you have to be your child's advocate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I really pity her, because when we do get to the end of this story, unfortunately, there's not a lot to, there's not a lot for her to go to sleep at night feeling good about.
Yeah, and the most heartbreaking thing is that Natasha's daughter is like, can I stay with my dad? Or sorry, not Natasha. Tammy's daughter, Natasha, is like, can I stay with my dad this summer? And she's like, no, you are not going to stay with a guy named Spider or whatever. So Natasha gets really kind of depressed about this. And Tammy's like, okay, yeah, you can go. And Tammy said, like, I will never forgive myself for not going with my instinct and telling her no. Because if I said no, like, she would probably be here today.
So
we get to meet Ingrid.
Yeah, we meet Chris. Oh, no. All right, you're on Ingrid. Go on.
Well, no, we just meet Ingrid, who's like Natasha's little best friend. And we learn a little bit more about Natasha's last day. So at 1 p.m., she had lunch with her aunt, presumably Sandra. And later that afternoon is when Clarence kept calling. So police arrive. They found her exactly how the aunt had found her, slumped on the floor. She had damp hair, and she had an electrical fan laid on top of her.
Yeah, definitely a weird thing. I mean, of course, we were playing around with the idea of maybe is it possible she was electrocuted because she was wet, but I don't know. It's one of those weird type of situations.
There's no outward sign of trauma to her body. Like, she looks fine, except that she's dead. Like, you wouldn't, she wasn't beaten, nothing like that. But we do meet Chris, and Chris is not his real name. We never know his real name, but he is a young local man who Natasha was, like, kind of seeing for the summer in Carson City. Now, according to Ingrid, Natasha's BFF, Chris had actually sexually assaulted Ingrid at a party 3 days earlier. Apparently, they were drinking. She passed out and she woke up with him on top of her. So she was like, I did not consent to this. This was not right.
I don't think Unsolved Mysteries did a very good job of bringing this abuse home.
Mm-mm.
I think it really gave the impression that she went to a party and hooked up with this guy. And that was it.
Yeah, I know. And I'm just like, is this how it was perceived in 2002? Like, that doesn't even seem like that long ago, but it's upsetting the stuff that you and I have uncovered before. Well, they'll leave rape out completely, or they will really downplay it. And I don't know. It's jarring.
Even Ingrid says that she blacked out and she thinks that Chris had raped her. And the fact of the matter is, this is about the only time that we're hearing any type of word from the source in a way. You know, she feels as though she was raped, and I feel as though it's dismissed.
I do too. And they actually interview Chris with the police, and the police are like, oh, well, there's no sign on her body that she's been sexually assaulted. So hold up here. Obviously not. It was 3 days before.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like it was a violent attack you in the alley kind of rape. It sounds like he was trying to sneak one by her while she was sleeping.
Blacking out. And, you know, I mean, that's what we're thinking, is it's a non-consensual moment. I don't know if this falls into that category of a violent rape, like you were saying. It's,
exactly.
Yeah, it was literally him taking advantage of a girl who's blacked out.
And she just hopped out of the shower. I would imagine she would have showered at least once after that party, sure, when you feel like this is what happened to you. So they're like, oh, okay, well, Chris, you are off the hook. And that is like the last we hear about Chris. And I want to take a little closer look at him.
Yeah, I'd like to know who he's related to.
Yeah, I'd like to know his real name. Oh, yeah, who he's related to on the police force.
Yeah, because, you know, why not look into this guy a little bit further? Because, I mean, there's an allegation. I mean, that's pretty... It seems damning to me that we're just kind of dismissing this. Oh, it's okay, go home.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe a slap on the wrist, but we don't know anything. So Natasha's mom goes to Carson City, and she does her, like, detective mom thing. She's making flyers. She's handing them out. And one day while she's at a mall, this woman like runs up to her, and she said the woman's like very scared and very skittish. And she just goes like, I know what happened to your daughter. So she like scribbles down her phone number, gives it to Tammy, the mom. And this woman tells us that Clarence, a.k.a. Spider, was a drug informant for the local cops, and that drug dealers found out and they killed Natasha in retaliation.
It just seems so fan fiction at this point.
Yeah, right. I would say plausible, but definitely not the most likely scenario.
Like, Clarence is definitely a shady guy and stuff. We've, of course, gone down this rabbit hole before in the sense of a drug informant or somebody being involved, you know, talking to the police, and then it gets released. And, you know, in the past, we've decided that it's plausible. But I don't know. Something about this one, and maybe the way the woman approached her in the reenactment isn't accurate, but it just seemed a little too unrealistic.
Yeah, it's something, it's food for thought. We got to take everything into consideration, but I definitely don't place it in my most likely scenario of what happened. So Tammy actually told this story to Clarence, and Clarence says, like, I was never an informant. I don't know what you're talking about. So according to Tammy, she got together this little posse of her family members, and they headed down to the detective's office to ask the detective if Clarence was an informant. And according to her, the detective said yes.
And it's like, what? You know, but Scott Burrow, is that how you pronounce it?
I think so.
Says that he's never been a documented informant.
Exactly. Emphasis on documented. Like, that's the word I took away.
I mean, don't they have these type of informants who are kind of, if you ever watch these like 70s cop dramas, like Kojak and stuff, it's kind of like they know people on the street to go and like you give them $50 and they give you information. I wonder mm-hmm. if it's the type of thing where it was literally like that. It's like, hey, you can, I know this or that or this, and you just kind of give me a few bucks and I'll tell to yeah. you.
Maybe he ratted once or twice, but never was like on the payroll.
But keyword but, being documented.
Yeah, I think so. So we get another theory, which I don't personally put stock in, but wait, like I said, we got to cover it all. So mm-hmm. the other theory is that Natasha killed herself by overdosing.
Even though there's yeah. no evidence of overdosing.
Right. There's no evidence of overdosing and there's no evidence of her wanting to kill herself or, you know, obviously it could be accidental too. But so there is a few pieces of really crazy evidence, if you ask me. So investigators find a tiny little scrap of plastic bag outside on the landing near her bedroom door. They test this little scrap. What would you say? It's like half of a dime size.
Yeah.
Torn off Ziploc, and they said that it contained trace amounts of methamphetamine.
Let me just ask you your opinion. They didn't, as far as we know, they didn't test the fan for any type of electrical thing.
Mm-mm.
They yeah. didn't find anything else except for this little tiny piece of plastic that had a little meth on it.
Exactly.
There's something that's just seeming to be, you know, we're being, our focus is being put on certain things and not other things. Mm-hmm. You know, like we're going to like Crisco. Because, you know, that's fine. But it could have been this little bit of meth. I don't mm-hmm. know. I don't think you overdose from a little tiny bit of meth.
No, and they find that there is trace amounts. Trace is so tiny amounts yeah. of the drug in her nostrils. So we meet Sarah Wecht, who's this, like, very, very famous pathologist. There's a whole segment of Unsolved Mysteries dedicated to yeah. him. He did JonBenet Ramsey's autopsy, JFK. Like, he is really a famous pathologist, and he posits that she did this drug, she got hot because of what they call hyperthermia, which happens when you take this meth, and so she took a bath to cool down.
Strange. I never heard of this, not with something that leaves a trace amount of something.
Exactly. And they say, oh, you know, and then she just started drying her hair with a fan. And we're talking like a room oscillating tall fan. Yeah. And then she died. So we get to learn that there was zero trace of drugs in her system.
Right.
So that rules out the overdose theory to me right there. Scott Burrow says that if she took the drugs at the party, then it would still be enough for her to overdose on 3 days later,
yeah.
which is so not. I don't think that's true.
Well, you know, I don't even believe when I take, you know, any type of acetaminophen or something where it says time release. I don't buy into any of that. Mm. So I'm certainly not going to buy into a time released meth or something.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure that like hard drugs like that, like cocaine, like that kind of stuff, stay in your body for like 2 or 3 days. Trace amounts of it, you know, if you were to test for it, I'm pretty sure that's how long that they stay in your system. But you're not constantly high for that whole amount of time. So like you said, time release methamphetamine. I've never heard of that before. So we officially have her cause of death as being undetermined. And like I said, the mom just kind of says that she wishes she never would have let her go. So the common consensus on the internet, you know, armchair detectives theory, is that she was electrocuted while trying to unplug or plug in the fan.
Yeah, I don't buy that personally.
I kind of do, because she was, okay, just keep in mind she was damp, fresh from the shower or the bath. And I found this like coroner forum where coroners ask questions to other coroners. And apparently, if it's a low voltage electrocution, there will be absolutely no signs on the outside of your body that shows that you've been electrocuted.
I don't know. I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm just saying we're not talking about low voltage though.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's still, I guess low voltage could, I don't know. I don't know what would be low voltage.
I don't know. I have no ideas. I'm saying that one I put on my most likely, but I'm not, I don't know, I wouldn't bet on it. But I mean, she could have had natural causes. I don't think it was a murder because there's no outward sign of trauma. She wasn't bleeding. I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely one of these things where I really, it bothers me so much that we have no idea
mm-hmm.
how she died. you know, I mean, they could have, I guess, said it was cardiac arrest or something like that, but
yeah,
because I guess if it was electrocution, wouldn't it be cardiac arrest? Wouldn't it lead to your heart stopping?
Oh, probably. Yeah, probably. It's just weird.
I don't know. It's weird. You know, I mean, even if it took a long way to get to that point, I wonder, who knows? I mean, this is one of those really weird things. I'm not going to say it's a cover up. I just think that people stopped caring. And that's really, really sad to me.
Yeah, I agree. Somebody who never stopped caring was Spider, a.k.a. Clarence. Sadly, he killed himself through a purposeful drug overdose in 2008. I found Tammy the Mom's Facebook. She is Facebook friends with, Ingrid, a.k.a. her little BFF. So that's nice. But yeah, there's sadly no answers from that. And I don't think we will get answers, but we do get answers in our next story.
This is a pretty popular story.
This guy has his own Wikipedia page.
Yeah, I wish I had one, but there wouldn't be nothing on it.
Not for this reason, yeah.
No. But Michael Afonso is convicted in 1990 of raping a 17-year-old girl. That's kind of where his, I guess, criminal history begins.
Mm-hmm.
In 1992, we went further than Unsolved Mystery with this one. This one, I feel as though Unsolved Mysteries left out a number of really kind of important details. Again,
big stuff. And you and I both watched another television show called I Almost Got Away With It. I know you guys know what we're talking about, but there was an episode called Got Dumped with his story on there.
Yeah.
So we did some extracurricular homework, watched that. And we got a lot of info.
I thought it was great. It was season one, episode two. And it's a really, really good episode. But in 1992, he's dating Su Minyer. And thank you for the phonetically writing out, Su Minyer Yang. And she just seems like, in the reenactment that I got from the ID show, it just seems like he's only hanging out with Asian girls. I don't know if that was like a thing. But
I didn't get that vibe at all, but okay.
Well, I'll mention when there are other Asian girls put into it. But he's dating her, and she mysteriously disappears when she says that she's going to work out things with her husband. Now, she was pregnant with his child.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, in the reenactment anyway, she was even showing. She'd made the decision that she was going to have an abortion. And go back to the husband. And this made Michael enraged. This guy definitely has anger issues. And this is one of the things that have triggered him. And it would become, I guess, something that will happen over and over again in this guy's life.
And, yeah, it's like you said, typical, if I can't have you, nobody can have you.
Yeah, and that's really one of those really sad and scary type of situations. So that's what triggered him. You're not going to kill my baby, so I'm going to kill you and kill the baby.
Well, I think you're not going to have an abortion was part of it, but I think it was like, you're not going to leave me. Like, this is not how this works, because that seems to be an issue with him later. So I think it's probably a double whammy, but as we've said 1,000 times before, the most dangerous time in an abusive relationship is when you're leaving, when the abuser is losing control.
Yeah. 3 days later, sometimes people get burned to death. It's awful.
Yeah. Exactly. But, and two months after her disappearance, her body is found in a remote area and she had been shot.
But according to Unsolved Mysteries, he's desperately willing to go to any point to save the relationship.
I hated the wording of this. I thought that they really made him seem like a victim, like a man in love. So it's 1995, Elgin, Illinois. They say that, like you said, desperately willing to go to any point to save a relationship. They show this while he's taking out a knife.
Right. He's willing to buy a knife.
Exactly. So his girlfriend, who's a single mother, Josefina Gonzalez, decides to meet up with him to hear him out. So she brings like her 2-year-old baby with her, and they meet at the hotel. And he's like, I love you. We got to get back together. And she's like, no, I want to break up with you. So here we go. And
I
want
to talk
you guys,
to the reenactor kid.
I love the reenactor so much. You know, I give like my most valuable reenactor award. This guy is my most valuable reenactor award for the entire series of Unsolved.
But let me ask you, do you like just his acting? Do you like his look? Do you like his,
I liked that he was giving 150%. He was so over the top. He was chewing the scenery. He was Like I said, he's either one of the most brilliant actors of our time or the actor is on meth. I can't tell. But like when he's screaming at her, it is like, it is straight from.
It's scary. It triggers. Yeah. It's like, whoa, this is.
It's like natural born killers. It's like dystopian. Like it looks weird. So she's like, I'm going to leave. So she's like holding the baby, right?
This is my favorite reenactor is the kid.
Oh my God. This kid should get hazard pay. So I will make a gif of this whole scene, but they go, they're arguing. She's holding the baby. He takes out his knife, stabs Josefina in the chest, and then takes the baby.
Oh my God.
So the baby is like a year and a half, 2 years old. And he just sees this lady, the actor just sees this lady just get stabbed, you know, and he doesn't know what's going on. So the baby starts crying. Then this crazy guy who he just saw screaming at this lady grabs him. So Josefina, like a boss in real life, grabs the knife, takes it, stabs Michael in the back. Michael tosses this baby. Like he straight up drops the baby. And there's just a scene where you see this poor little baby go ass over tea kettle. His like feet are kicking up.
Yeah, like he really dropped him like a good 2 feet above the ground.
Exactly. And the baby is like screaming. And as I said, we will post a gif of that Unsolved Mysteries Rewind on Facebook.
There are, I had to rewind. There are laws, you know, for Coogan's Law, you know. Children need to be safe.
Exactly. So Michael Alfonso, I mean, that was like a very cool mother bear, like don't F with my kids moment,
yes.
But I did not, I wish they would have replaced it with like a doll. So Michael Alfonso goes to the hospital to try and get treated for this like gaping knife wound in his back. And that is when he is arrested. So he is convicted of aggravated battery and he serves only 4 years in prison.
Now, is this the only woman that we're going to bring up that actually survives one of his attacks?
I think so, yeah. That we know about. You know, who knows who else is out there who didn't report anything.
But, I mean, in our story, I mean, it's really shocking in a lot of ways that this person was either not caught or he... I don't. It, we learned so much from the ID thing as well, because he does go on the run later.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, he has, like, a tropical runaway vacation, so... he does get out of prison in 1998. In 1998, like 2 months later, he actually goes back for criminal sexual abuse. Then in 2001, June of 2001, we meet 25-year-old mother of three, Henna Velasquez. She's separated from her husband and she's working two jobs to support her kids. One of them, they say, is at a fast food restaurant. And I'm assuming it's McDonald's because the title of this whole segment is called McDonald's.
An ID says it's McDonald's.
Oh, I
actually, they have
that.
Actual footage of this of the crime on the episode. Yeah,
I wasn't watching close enough. So,
okay.
I know when she was also working at like a construction job. So Michael Alfonso is working with her at the construction job. Mm. Her husband, her ex-husband, who's like on the outs with her, is actually working with her at McDonald's,
which is strange, of course. But you know what's weird is they don't really go into it at all. With him.
No.
And in the ID special, they mention how he was working the day that this all goes down.
Yeah, there's definitely differences when we get to like when it goes down. So we get to meet Renee Anderson in the Unsolved Mystery, who is Henna's co-worker. She says that Henna confided that she was having marriage troubles. And I also saw that, you know, they're working at the same place. They could tell the tension was getting between this husband and wife. So.
Of course.
Henna starts getting like tons of phone calls from a man who we assume is Michael Alfonso at work. And Henna decided that she needed to leave this crazy guy behind and she's going to try and make things work with her husband. So we meet Detective Dave Zidane, who is in both of the I Almost Got Away With It and Unsolved Mysteries. And he says that Michael is a, quote, violent and unpredictable man. And I agree with him.
Yeah, it's. I think that this, oh man, I just did something. All right, stupid. Yeah, he's definitely violent, unpredictable, but she was so scared that she called the police since he was threatening her. But
yeah, he comes up to her and is like, you don't leave me. Like, I am going to kill your whole family.
Offering the same exact rage that the other people have gotten. We're seeing it over and over again. And the police are like, well, we're going to speak to him. And he's like, no, you can't talk to him. I'm wondering, what does she want the police to do?
Well, she's like, I'm scared that he's going to retaliate against me, which is very plausible. They always say, you know, get a restraining order, but a piece of paper is not going to stop a crazy person from coming to you. So.
But also, if you're calling the police, you can't, I mean, are you just letting them know? I mean, what, are you going to have a squad car follow you? I mean, I'm just.
Yeah, well, that is what happened. That night, actually, a squad car, like, was constantly outside of her house.
Oh, okay. So maybe I'm wrong.
The night that she called the police. So they were protecting her, but she was like, I don't want anything, like, officially out there because I'm afraid that he will murder me. So the next day, she pulls into McDonald's, and he is, like, standing there in the reenactment. He's just, like, in the parking lot waiting for her. Now, Hannah's husband also worked for McDonald's, and he was, like, taking a nap on the other side of the building in the car.
Right.
So I guess they took two different cars to work that day. I'm not really sure.
But also, ID states that he was on a smoke break, and he was just outside when he heard the gunfire.
Yeah, so Michael...
Not that it matters, really, but...
Yeah, it's so different that it does kind of matter. Like, it's so opposite.
But in the reenactment, also, he goes up to Hannah and shoots her, right? Yeah. I'm forgetting his first name. I'm sorry.
Michael
shoots her. And with a 357 Magnum, which is a pretty large caliber gun, and very loud. That's another thing. So he shoots her, and in the ID reenactment, the husband runs over to her and is there, you know, basically
like holds
comforting
her in his arms. Yeah.
So, but in the reenactment, it's the manager, that woman.
Yeah, the friend Renee.
So I thought that was a little bit weird.
See, these are the, like we were saying, like it's such different details that it does make a difference. Like, I want to know. So yeah, Michael chased her down, emptied his gun on this poor woman. And now there's a witness in the drive-thru who says that when he passed her, he like ran to his car, that he was smirking. Now in the ID channel show, he was smirking.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we know he
was
smirking.
What the hell he was doing in Unsolved Mysteries. I've never seen that face before. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen, and I will post a GIF of that.
Yeah, he's almost like when you're at a carnival and you're throwing darts at the balloons and you get one and you win the big prize, you make this face.
Yeah.
I'll take the panda.
That's exactly what it is.
It is kind of funny that he's making this bizarre face in Unsolved Mysteries.
This guy is just so over the top. That's why I love him. Like I said, like I need a bad infomercial level of actor in my Unsolved Mysteries reenactment.
So he went on the run. He got into his really awesome Firebird, 1994 black Firebird. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just kind of left. I mean, that was the thing. He, in the ID thing, he abandons the gun. He throws it down a storm drain and abandons the car. And makes his way south, I think it was. He was going towards Mexico.
Hannah is pronounced dead shortly after going to the hospital. And yeah, they said that he does go south. He was, he is fluent in Spanish, which is interesting. So he is like, I am going to clean up down there. So he like hops the border of Mexico, goes to Belize, goes to back to Veracruz, hangs out in Cancun for a while, works
traveling with that one guy, though, which I thought was weird in the ID reenactment.
Yeah, so they hold him in Belize in like immigration, and they're like, where's your passport, all this stuff. So they end up holding him for like 10 months, let him and some other guy go, and then they kind of go on the run together. And then they said one day that guy just started flipping out, and so Michael's like, you're a little too crazy even for my crazy ass. So then he like leaves him. And in January of 2003, he was actually placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives list. And in 2004, he was arrested in Veracruz, Mexico.
Right. Did you hear what he said when he was in jail in Mexico? He was talking about how there are a lot of guys down there he recognized from Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He said that he said that this American tourist came up to him when he was working at a strip club in Cancun and was like, oh, hey, I saw you on America's Most Wanted last night.
And he's like, if we can take this as a tip, maybe they should check out the jail in Mexico, because apparently there's a lot of fugitives down there.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that was really interesting. I think that you and I had different. I almost got away with it. Experiences, because I was watching like a pirated copy off YouTube.
Oh no.
And it was like only the top quarter of the shot.
Oh, really?
All screen. Right. Yeah. So I was missing a lot, but I saw the smirk.
All right. Well, this is why we have to expand all of our viewing pleasure. We need more access to these things. So
totally. But you know, we got the point across. He gets extradited to the United States. He is sentenced to 3 life sentences, one for Sumanier, one for Henna, and one for Sumanier's baby. It was like unlawful homicide of an unborn child.
Now,
so
let me just ask you, I'm sorry.
Please.
How do we know how pregnant she was?
No.
Because I'm not to go down this crazy rabbit hole, but at what point is it, are we no longer calling it like a fetus and all this kind of stuff? I don't know if there's a, when it comes to killing the entity, yeah. I'm just wondering if you, like, say it's an 8-month, the child's 8-month in utero. Is that considered, you know, something that can live on its own and you get a full life sentence for that? Or
Great
is
question.
It like 8 weeks in and it's kind of, cause she was thinking about having an abortion. So it couldn't have been too far along.
Great point. Yeah. If it was through the proper channels, you know, it could have been.
And that's another thing is it's also one of these things where, and I'm not judging anybody who makes these decisions, of course, it's just, I'm wondering on a lawful aspect of it, whether they just said, you know what, on top of it, we're also going to give you a life sentence for this just because you're a jerk.
I have an answer for you. Now, the frustrating part of the answer is I'm sure it varies state by state. The non-frustrating part of the answer is I saw a very special SVU one time starring John Ritter. And he killed his pregnant wife in a parking garage.
John Ritter did?
Yeah.
I worked with John Ritter.
Oh, well, we'll talk about that. But the whole thing is if the baby, their lungs were expanded, like if the child has taken a breath, then it's its own life. It's its own entity. It's its own thing. If it hasn't taken a breath of air and it's only like amniotic fluid, whatever it's breathing in there, then it is still considered a fetus, even if it's a viable fetus.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that there's a chart somewhere, right?
Yeah, I'm sure. And like I said, I'm sure it varies state by state. I think this is Illinois. So Illinois, I'm sure, is a lot more conservative than like New York.
I need to know what this movie was. So please let me know and we'll put it in the show notes.
Oh, Law and Order SVU.
Oh, he was on an episode of Law and Order SVU.
Yeah.
All right. I'll dig that up.
Okay.
But John Ritter, rest in peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Of course. Yeah. This is only a character.
Yes. It's only a character. It's Jack Tripper. So, yeah, I mean, so he's in prison still. He actually was on the ID special.
Yeah. We'll post a picture of him. It's the most recent photo I can find of him.
He doesn't seem too upset about it. I mean, this is from 10 years ago, but he doesn't seem to have much regret on any of it. The only thing he regretted is that when he killed Sumanier, he didn't learn the lesson at that point, and he continued on with his murderous rampages.
I'm sure if he was out tomorrow, you know, I'm sure old habits die hard. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, it's this is a very eye-opening episode, but I thought that I was really glad to see that this person was in prison, and at least he's still in there and he can't hurt anyone.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Yeah. But Kim, thank you very much for getting together for this wonderful episode.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you for doing it with me.
If you enjoy this podcast, subscribe, of course. But if you also want to hit us up on Facebook.com, you just search for Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. We are the one that is the best one, whatever that means. And we just love the entire thing. The more we do these episodes, the more I think that it opens up all of the possibilities on each episode. Each one, when we jump into it, it just seems really fresh. So even though the episode was aired, when was this first aired? I'm sorry.
18 years ago.
18 years ago. The stories really do get this wonderful update, I think. And that's what I think that this podcast really provides to people, is an update to today. Mm-hmm. And without your research, it just wouldn't be as updated.
Oh, well, thank you.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.